Daniel Ziblatt is worried about the future of democracy around the world and increasingly here in the U.S. He's a professor of government at Harvard, co-author of the book How Democracies Die, and he sees a lot of warning signs. Authoritarian leaders like Putin in Russia, Erdogan in Turkey, Orban in Hungary, Bolsonaro in Brazil, these are no longer outliers. They have consolidated power and shared goals. Ziblatt says there's a playbook for how demagogues destroy their country's democracies. Steve Paulson wanted to know what it means for the U.S.
Do you think American democracy is in danger now?
Certainly it is. There are a lot of threats. Currently, I would say the greatest vulnerability of American democracy, if I had to put my finger on one factor, I would say the radicalization of the Republican Party. It's sometimes a hard point to begin with because one sounds like a partisan, but I come to this as a student of conservatism. I've written a book on the history of conservative parties in Western Europe in the 19th and 20th centuries. And so think actually that a robust constitutional center-right party is critical for democracy. But I think increasingly we have large segments of the Republican Party that are not behaving as democratic political party. And so that when you have only one political party fully committed to democratic rules and norms, this poses a great threat.
When you say that the current Republican Party, at least the faction that's in power right now, sort of the Trump faction, doesn't accept democracy, break that down a little bit for me.
Yeah. So again, that's just, I understand the weight of that charge, and it'll sound to some of your listeners like a partisan kind of statement. So it's really important to be clear about this. Scholars of democracy have made very clear that there are three basic benchmarks to assess whether a political party or politicians are democratic. Number one, they have to accept election results. Democracies can't survive if parties and politicians don't know how to accept defeat. Number two, political parties and politicians need to eschew violence, not participate in violent acts to try to gain power or to hold on to power. This is a clear lesson from the 1920s and 1930s when you had communists and fascists in the street who were willing to use violence to gain power.
And so you're saying, for instance, the January 6th insurrection would be the obvious example.
Would be an obvious example, of course. And this points then to the third key factor, which is a bit more subtle. To be a democratic political party, not only can you not participate in violence and do you have to accept election results, you have to distance yourself from political actors, groups, parties, activists who participate in those first two behaviors. You have to join forces with maybe your ideological opponents, but who are also similarly committed to democracy. Really on that third dimension, I think that in many ways we see some dangers within the Republican Party. What we see looking at history, again, 1920s, 1930s Europe, it's often the mainstream parties who kind of turned a blind eye or talked out of both sides of their mouth when seeing their ideological allies participating in violence that got democracy into trouble.
So I want to put this discussion in a larger historical context. I mean, really, what can happen for a country to lose its democracy? Because I think the first thing we think about is, oh, an elected leader is deposed in a coup. Salvador Allende in Chile. The military comes in and they assassinate him. But there are plenty of other examples where a demagogue is elected through reasonably fair elections. Most notorious case would probably be Hitler in 1933. How did that happen?
The story of how Hitler came to power is in many ways paradigmatic and also in many ways unique. The broader lessons that one can draw from this are the potential recklessness of mainstream parties when they make short-term calculations and align themselves with political leaders who are a genuine threat to democracy, and mainstream politicians overlook those threats. So in the late 1920s, you had a very strong social democratic political party in Germany on the one hand. You had a highly fragmented political landscape in the middle. You had a conservative party that was falling apart at the right end of the spectrum. And then Hitler emerged kind of out of the blue, having been an obscure figure through most of the 1920s after an attempted coup in the early 20s. By the late 1920s, he appeared on the scene, and this conservative party that was falling apart, they saw Hitler and realized we can join forces with Hitler. We can hold joint election rallies with Hitler, push common legislation, and we will use the energy that seems to be in the streets for Hitler to shore up our political party. We're an elitist party. We don't have a mass base. We can align with this figure, and we can use him.
They thought they could control him.
They thought they could control him. They thought they could ride him to power. Over the course of the next several years, between 1928 and 1933, the tables were very quickly turned, and it turned out Hitler was using these establishment forces to gain legitimacy. And so by the early 1930s, without a real conservative party left, President Hindenburg, who named the chancellor, in effect the prime minister, turned to Hitler and appointed him chancellor. And once in power, Hitler, of course, established dictatorial rule.
Mm-hmm. So we might assume that these demagogues always come from the right, right-wing extremists. That's not the case. Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, similarly elected, popular leader at first, and then he also consolidated power. What happened there?
Yeah, a very similar story, but on the left. You had a mainstream president, Rafael Caldera. He freed Hugo Chavez from jail after Chavez had attempted a coup earlier, a few years earlier. Why he did this is a kind of matter of a lot of historical debate, but clearly one of the reasons was he thought that by doing this, he could tap into the popularity of Chavez. And this only legitimated Chavez, and Chavez was now a political actor on the mainstream stage, ran for president, won, and then once in power began to attack democratic institutions. One of the things I should say is that when these figures, they typically are outsiders, these people who go on to often attack democratic rules in this way, they often have not a lot of political experience, but usually they send out warning signs of they're going to be dangerous. They use violent rhetoric, they attack the media, they cast their political opponents as existential enemies to the nation. And so when you see politicians behaving this way, speaking this way, sometimes we think that politicians don't follow through on their promises. Unfortunately, they often do. And these figures often are as authoritarian as advertised.
To take Hugo Chavez as an example, so what were the steps for him to consolidate power? I assume that first thing is he marginalizes his political opponents. He tries to get rid of the opposition media. I mean, the media that would call him to account. And at a certain point, rewrites the laws, right? Rewrites the Constitution.
In my book, How Democracies Die with Steve Levitsky, we use the analogy of a soccer game to kind of try to help understand this process by which elected leaders attack democratic institutions, because there is a kind of playbook, there's a set of strategies that reinforce each other. The first thing that these kinds of figures, including Chavez and others, Viktor Orban, Erdogan in Turkey, have pursued is they try to capture the referees. I mean, this is like a soccer game. They try to capture the referees. Those are the impartial umpires of a political game. So whether courts, judges, investigative bodies, prosecutors, those actors who are supposed to be impartial to enforce the rule of law. For authoritarian demagogues, these figures are both an opportunity and a challenge.
When you say they capture, they get rid of the neutral referees and put in their people?
They do this through a couple of ways. Number one, they often will force out people who won't play ball with them. So what Viktor Orban did, just to use that example, is he imposed a retirement age on all the judges and changed the rules about how to select judges and essentially set up his party leaders in a position where they could now select all these new judges as the old judges were being forced out. But one can also intimidate them, bribe them, coerce them, blackmail them. And so that's the first thing. The second thing that these leaders do, as in a soccer game, you want to go after the opposition players. And so one thing that often happens with these regimes, they go after the private sector, whether this is big business, sometimes labor unions, sometimes cultural figures, sports stars, musicians, popular musicians, to get these guys on their side or to silence them. And then the final step is to kind of lock in the advantages. And the way that these figures lock in the advantages is by tilting the playing field, is the analogy that we use. And so what this means is changing the rules of the game, usually election rules, to make it so that it's harder and harder to vote out the incumbent.
Give me an example of that. I mean, how do the election rules actually get changed?
Yeah, so one thing would be to redraw a kind of form of gerrymandering. You redraw the election districts in a way to make sure that your party is at an advantage so that the opposition party has to win more votes in order to win the same number of seats. And what all of this means is that the opposition can still win, but it becomes harder and harder. The opposition has to get bigger and bigger in order to even reach a kind of 50% threshold.
So in all of these cases, Viktor Orban, Hitler, Chavez, they were all very charismatic leaders, populists, I guess we would call, and their rallying cry was, we represent the people. We're going to get rid of that power elite that has ruled this country. Is that a foundational principle in all these cases?
Yes, this is. And I think the key feature of their charisma, if we want to call it that, is that they are outsiders. They were not part of the political establishment. And so the way they get into power is railing against the establishment and pointing out the flaws that genuinely are there. These figures can come along and say, hand power to me and I can get stuff done. Now, that said, you know, sometimes outsiders are a good thing for a democracy. I mean, I think outsiders can bring a breath of fresh air. But it's a double-edged sword in a certain way, because it does open the door for these kinds of leaders who ultimately go on, who, frustrated with democratic politics, go on to attack it.
So let's get to a more complicated case, Donald Trump, who certainly shares some of these qualities that you've been talking about, you know, refuses to acknowledge the election results, charismatic leader to his followers. How much does he fit this playbook?
He fits it pretty well. So as a candidate, does one threaten violence? Does one go after the media? Does one challenge the legitimacy of one's rivals to run for office? And suddenly, 2015, 2016, we saw a politician in American politics who had a viable chance of winning the presidency who fit that test to a T.
So you're saying there were all these warning signs when Trump was running for president, became president, and certainly rocked the boat, pushed against every institutional safeguards, but the system held.
Yes, it held. I would say just barely in some respects. I think the work of the January 6th committee has increasingly shown that there was a plan at the highest levels, if not to overthrow the government through violent seizure of power and murder, but there was an attempt at least to block the counting of ballots in a way that would have handed the presidency to Joe Biden. Now, I think, you know, we overcame this. There was a transition in power. And so in this sense, our checks and balances did work. But one of the important things that determines the long-run viability of a democracy is, how is the history written about those events? We're in the midst of this right now, and making sure that we have a real fact-based account of this, and this is why the work of the January 6th committee is so important. If we have a kind of false narrative of what happened, or a contested narrative of what happened, this weakens, I would say, the immune system of our democracy for future events like this.
So I want to come back to this idea of the importance of distancing an extreme candidate, basically to say, that guy is beyond the pale. Mm-hmm. And you're saying that should have happened with Donald Trump. But Republicans should have said he is beyond the pale. I'm just wondering how that might happen. I mean, I guess in the old days, it was what? The party bosses would go in the back room and say, sorry, this guy, he's unacceptable, which seems very anti-democratic, frankly.
Yeah. I want to start by saying there's no shortage of demagogues in American history who want to be president. Henry Ford, George Wallace, jumping around the 20th century, Joe McCarthy, perhaps, Huey Long, Democrats and Republicans. In every instance, before 1972, because political parties selected their candidates not through primaries primarily, but rather getting together of political leaders in smoke-filled back rooms at conventions and sitting in hotels outside of convention halls and reviewing who the potential contenders are, striking deals, knowing which of these guys were demagogues, they would get together and keep some of these kinds of figures out. So, you know, one of my favorite stories in this regard is the wonderful novel Plot Against America by Philip Roth, where he imagines this counterfactual history where Charles Lindbergh, the famous pilot, decides he wants to run for president, and he had presidential ambitions. He was one of these figures.
And was a Nazi sympathizer.
And the Republican Party decides they're going to select him as their nominee. He comes to the convention hall wearing his flight goggles, having flown in and landed his own plane at the convention. Totally plausible sounding scenario. Comes in, gets selected as the nominee, runs against Roosevelt, wins, and the United States forms alliances with Adolf Hitler's Germany. So this is, you know, a terrible counterfactual history. The thing about it, though, is that it was totally implausible. It's a great novel. Everybody should read it. But it's totally implausible in the pre-1972 world where party candidates were selected by party leaders. Lindbergh would have never made it through the smoke-filled rooms. After 1972, the world changed because we introduced binding primaries, where each state, we all know the very messy process, state by state, parties run primaries, caucuses, and so on, where they select their candidates. Some level, it's certainly more democratic. Voters get to have a say, but it's double-edged. You know, at the time these reforms were introduced, critics of the reform who said this is going to open the door to demagogues. The system lasted pretty well and survived pretty well until 2016. In 2016, Donald Trump, the kind of Charles Lindbergh, I would say, of our own day, made it through the primary process and became the nominee.
So why did the system hold in the U.S. when Trump made every effort to overturn the election, and not just overturn the election, but attack all the governmental institutions throughout his presidency? It seems like you could make the argument it was because the bureaucrats, enough of them at least, stood their ground. People in different government agencies, judges, when Trump made a decree, say, no, that's not constitutional. One after another of these government officials sort of said, no, you can't do that.
I think one of the least appreciated strengths and sources of resilience of American democracy are not only government officials, local government officials, nobody knows their names, but more broadly, professionals, whether lawyers, journalists, military officers, people who abide by a professional ethos, which limits the kinds of things they're willing to do and gives them the courage, in fact, to stand up to bullies. You have a professional ethos, a professional code that you abide by, and that inoculates you in some ways from the kind of pressures of authoritarianism. Authoritarians don't like professionals because they are incorruptible.
So there is one other question that I'd love to explore with you. Maybe democracy is not the best form of government, because certainly you can see this scenario coming back to our discussion of the demagogue who is fairly elected, very charismatic, comes to power by appealing to a majority of voters, attacking opponents, marginalizing unpopular groups, and can stay in power that way. Maybe through purely democratic means, without cheating, be in power.
Yeah, so this is certainly a vulnerability of democracy, but you have to ask, what are the alternatives to this? I think there's no question in my mind that democracy is superior to alternative forms of authoritarian governance. And let me just explain why. Number one, I mean, we can look at what's happening in Russia today and the invasion of Ukraine. I think in many ways, what we see is the consequences of arbitrary power. We might say, well, that's an unfair comparison. Nobody wants to live, let's say, in an authoritarian regime like Russia. But, you know, there are modernizing authoritarian regimes, non-democratic regimes, Singapore, maybe China. These are the real alternative models on offer. And so we have to stop and kind of make an evaluation. And the way I think about this is that democracies are highly transparent. When you look at a democracy, it's like looking in your neighbor's windows with the blinds drawn open. I mean, you can kind of see everything that's happening. You see all of the family fights. You see all of the disagreements. And it's very easy to misinterpret that as weakness. Authoritarian regimes are not transparent. We don't know what's happening in most authoritarian regimes. All of the fights happen behind closed shades. And so I think it's a mistake to interpret the conflict that one sees in democracies as a sign of weakness. In many ways, what we're witnessing and the struggles that we see today in the United States and in Western Europe and the rise of demagogues are efforts at self-correction. And so when you have demagogues come along, this is a sign that we have to reform. We need to adjust. And our systems are self-correcting. And so the great virtue, I would say, of democracy is that it provides within it a system of self-correction. Authoritarian systems don't have that. And so that's one of the great underappreciated strengths of democracy.
Daniel Ziblatt is a professor of government at Harvard and the co-author with Steve Levitsky of How Democracies Die. He talked with Steve Paulson.